Welcome to Voice Rising with Kara Johnstad. Enjoy weekly conversations with leading luminaries, pioneering visionaries, singers, poets, musicians, and sound healers as we explore the profound role our voice plays on the path to self-realization and global enlightenment. The internationally acclaimed singer, composer, author, healer, recording artist, voice expert, creator of Voice Your Essence, and founder of the School of Voice, Kara Johnstad, uses her extraordinary spiritual gifts to empower others. Everything in this world vibrates. Everything has a frequency. A pioneer in the field of voice work and transformational songwriting. Her breakthrough methods are helping thousands of people worldwide fine-tune their body-mind-spirit system and unlock the energetic frequencies of limitless creativity, health, and abundance. Share your voice, ask your questions, join in the conversation. Receive life-changing, positive transformation and rise together to create a sound world. And here's your host, Kara Johnstad.
Everybody, a very big welcome to the show today. And with me in studio is a Canadian writer, teacher, dream worker, Tokopa Turner, who blends the mystical tradition of Sufism with a Jungian approach to dreams. She is the founder of the Dream School and sometimes called a midwife of the psyche. So the world has never been more connected, and yet people have never felt more lonely. First of all, Tokopa, you've written this amazing book, and I really want to not only welcome you to the show, but to say one big thank you. This book is called Belonging, Remembering Ourselves Home, and that is the theme today. So first of all, welcome to the show, and you belong here. That's all I want to say.
Thank you so much, Kara. It's a pleasure to be here with you today.
Oh, beautiful. So belonging, remembering ourselves home. The world is so connected. We're all connected. Here we are on this show between Berlin, Pennsylvania. We're also on the west coast of Canada. We have our iPhones, we have our tablets, and yet so many people have a sense of loneliness. They're anxious about finding their place in this world. You talk about the absence of belonging as a great silent wound of our time. Can you share with us a bit more why so many of us feel as if we don't belong in our world?
Of course. Well, you know, the book Belonging is really an attempt to understand the dimensionality of this great word, belonging. And it came out of my own personal impulse to understand what that longing to belong was really about, where its roots were in my own life. But of course, as I began to explore my personal relationship with belonging and not belonging, with belonging and exile, I discovered that I wasn't alone in this ache, and that the more that I spoke to others about it, the more I realized that this was this great wound that we in modern times are suffering with. And so the book is an attempt to open up that conversation. And so what I discovered is that there are really three levels, we can say, to that sense of exile and of displacement in our lives. And quite simply, those things are at the personal level. We experience a kind of estrangement from who we really are. And that happens, we can talk more about each of these things, but that happens usually through the environment and culture that we're raised in. And then there's the level of culture itself and how the culture that we have built and are growing actually fosters alienation and loneliness. And then there is this greater level, which is ancestral. And at the ancestral level, we can trace back the displacement of so many people and mm-hmm. how people have been separated from their people's land of origin, and then trying to take root in a new place and all of the difficulties and barriers involved in that.
Right, exactly. So as a child, you grew up in a Sufi community, and you were surrounded by fellow travelers and Sufi music, which has a lot to do, people that know Sufi music, about this longing for the beloved, that songs that give voice to return to the beloved. You have a quote from Rumi in your book, which is talking about the story of the reed, and it says, since I was cut from the reed bed, I have made this crying sound, so we carry a pain within of being separated. So we are seeking to become the flute that is played and comes alive from existence moving through us. We are longing to return to the divine from which we human reeds were plucked. And so when you were singing and dancing and eating together in this community, at the same time, you write in the book, you still felt somehow this feeling of being a misfit. So do you remember a powerful turning point in your childhood when you were made aware of the power of your voice and that your voice literally had the ability to, make powerful decisions and also connect you to a group, but also take you away from that group?
Oh, that's a big question. I have so many specific memories around using my voice and not using my voice.
Mm-hmm.
But that brief time in which I was raised in a Sufi community was a time for me that I associate to great connectedness. And we used to sing zikr, which is a kind of singing the many different names of God or mm-hmm. The source, whatever you want to call it. In the Sufi tradition, we call it the beloved, the friend. Mm-hmm. And so those times where we would reuse our voices together to kind of enter into this ecstatic state where perhaps one of the greatest memories of my childhood. But then my family left the Sufi community and moved to the suburbs. And that was really where things changed a lot for me. It became a much more, I guess the traditional nuclear family. And then we were very much faced with the conflicts of that family unit. And so I do tell some of my memoirs in the book about how I left home at a very young age and entered the foster system. So I had these very extremes to my story. I did have this sense of great belonging within the Sufi community, but later I became completely alone and isolated.
I was also hooking in because you talk a lot. I guess my passion is voice, and I sense this also, that everybody has a vibrational essence in their a voice to their soul, a true longing. And you can hear that also in good writers, that they have their own unique voice, or that we have our own, speaking voice. And you were talking about in the book also how you remember just being really passionate and talkative and too loud and sometimes too dramatic, and yet realize that to be accepted, you often had to go into a kind of a coolness or pulling ourselves back from our expressiveness, right? So I was wondering what it's like for you now as a teacher, and you're also you founded the Dream School. What is this balance that we have between, everybody knows that when a child is really happy and in that imaginative world and playing, normally the voice is really babbling and full of, you know, longing and play. And at the same time, we have this idea that our spirituality is often sit in silence, go into silence, be more quiet, be more calm. What is your experience with that, with your own voice, when you're seeking to find new ideas and to work through things? Is it more a babbling, talkative ecstasy, or do you feel? Yeah, I don't know. I was just curious about that because I think that voice has so much expression in it.
Let's see, you know, my history is as a professional musician. So before I got into teaching, I played guitar and wrote my own songs and toured with a band and made an album of original music. And so
beautiful.
I loved to sing and pursued music very passionately for a great deal of my life. And when it came to writing, I have always found that when I'm writing, I sound my words out loud to myself because the music contained in language is extremely important to me. So often when I'm writing, I put a sentence together, sometimes first by sound, because that is often my priority. I might need a vowel here at the end of a sentence, you know, so I think that musicianship has carried through to my writing. And now with teaching, I've discovered that I love orating. It's a wonderful part of my passion, just being able to especially be in a room with other women and just allow what wants to come through to come through in the moment, and being able to put that into words. And I am in present time very much challenged on speaking, the speaking front, because I have a disease called rheumatoid disease, and one of the things that it does is it affects your lungs quite severely. So I don't always have the breath and ability. Sometimes my words get dropped because of that. So it's challenging to learn how to speak in a new way.
But this explains why I fell in love with your book, because you can hear you can sense the poetry. It's very, very complex, and it's very deep, and it has so many layers. But at the same time, there are so many pictures, so you can feel it when you're reading it as if it was spoken. So that makes sense that you sometimes speak the lines, because, you know, good poetry also, it should sing off the page, we say, right? So it should be singing off the page. So you are the founder of a dream school, or the dream school, which I think is very cool, because we don't pay that much attention often to our dreams, and yet we're spending at least a third of our life in dreams, right? We're at least probably 8 hours a day we are in the dream world. You talk about that dreams are the first place where alienation appears. So share with us a little bit why, or about dreams and why you decided to open your school and build your community of dream makers and dream weavers, and why dreams can be such a powerful source of healing, or maybe guidance for our lives.
Ever since I was very young, I had these extremely powerful dreams, and some of them were narrative dreams, like the kind we're used to, but some of them were prophetic, and some of them were experiential. So things would happen to me, and things would be transmitted to me in the dream time. And it probably wasn't until I was 19 or 20 years old when I discovered the work of Carl Jung, the great Swiss pioneer of analytical psychology. And And that was when I discovered this whole slew of authors and thinkers and philosophers who seemed to be speaking the language of my soul. And I started to realize this was a field and this was a legitimate path of exploration, and I wasn't alone. So I became deeply involved in learning the Jungian way, and also influenced by many of the other indigenous traditions around dreaming practices around the world. And it was in 2001 that I decided to start speaking publicly about dreams and starting to teach about dreams. So that was ultimately the founding of the Dream School, simply out of a longing to wanting to have community around being interested in dreams and sharing our dreams. And this thing grew really into my great passion and the field in which I had decided to devote my life. And so the thing about dreams is that we spoke earlier very briefly about how estrangement or alienation really takes root. And one of the big ways in which it takes root is in our personal lives. When we grow up in a family or a community or a church or an institution where we are taught that certain qualities within us are valuable and esteemed, while other qualities are dismissed, ignored, or devalued, even laughed at or derided, then what happens is the personality tries to develop on the bias, which is acceptable, right? And we all have this experience of becoming split off from, perhaps we could say, original aspects of the self. But then later in life, those devalued aspects return, and they return in our dreams. And sometimes when we don't pay attention to them returning, they turn up their volume. And this is when we get nightmares and threatening images. And it's a kind of trying to get our attention. So we will finally turn to that which has been neglected, what I call the refugee aspects of the self, and begin to work at turning towards them, starting to understand what it is that they may want, and eventually, even hopefully, reclaiming the inherent medicine that is carried in those figures and images and symbols.
Yeah, what are some of the ways that we can then heal the wound of these, or reclaim these lost parts that have been rejected, unseen, hurt, or left behind? What are some of the tools that we have available?
Well, you know, the practice that I focus on is dream work. And I make this connection between dream work and belonging, because the way that I understand dream work is really what we're doing is looking at the landscape of the soul, looking at the landscape of the psyche, and seeing what is showing up there, either which needs to be healed and integrated, or often what has yet to be discovered. And what we do in dream work is we, I use this word courtship, because what instead of running away from what's difficult in our dreams, instead we practice at becoming curious and asking the right questions that might draw to us closer those things that have become estranged. And so this is a process that can happen quickly. It could happen in the course of working with one dream. It can happen over the course of working with a series of dreams. But what we're essentially learning to do is to make a courtship, which is to say, discovering what the other wants or what the other needs, and then trying to move our lives in response to that need.
Is it similar when people talk about how can I how can I parent my inner child, that if we have a sense that it's from, I don't know, like in a dream, that we have a sense that we were rejected, that we welcome, instead of feeling terrible about our rejection, that we kind of welcome that in and say, okay, next time that appears in my daily life, how can I show up and become more vulnerable? Or how can I not take it so personally? Or how can I go from seeing this, the realization that happens, that I see the dream, I understand it, and then I can move into my daily life so that I can...
Yeah. Well, you know, I teach long form courses around dream work because unfortunately it's not something we can summarize so quickly. But let me give you an example just so you can, so it comes out of the abstract. Let's say you have a dream about a grizzly bear and it's chasing you. And in the dream, you're terrified. You wake up, you're in a sweat, your heart is racing, and you think, oh, what a terrible dream. I don't even want to look at that, and you try and go about your daily life, right? So step one is actually acknowledging that something important is happening here. And the first step is to write the dream down. And if you can get that far, you've already made a huge accomplishment because you have penetrated the urge to dismiss the dream or push the dream away. And instead, you are drawing it a little closer. And now the next step is to look at the images in your dream. In this case, we have this terrifying grizzly bear. And maybe instead of running from it, we turn towards it energetically. And we say, well, what is going on with this bear? Well, as you explore it and you ask yourself some questions about this dream, you might decide, well, the bear is actually really angry. It is in a rage because perhaps its home or its cave has been disturbed. Maybe that's what you discover through your exploration. So then you do this thing you were referring to, which is bridging it back to waking life. And you can ask yourself the question, well, where in my life does it feel like a private space is being disturbed? And then maybe you remember, oh my gosh, somebody walked right in on my writing retreat. I had the door closed and they walked in on me and I felt like I was in a rage, but I didn't say anything. And instead I was just quiet about it. So oops, it shows up in the dream and it says something is not being expressed here and it's very powerful and I'm running away from it. So then you might realize, okay, I need to be able to express that bear rage in the moment that it happens in order to honor that wild energy that is inside of me. That doesn't mean, you know, you're going to unleash your rage in the relationship, but your boundaries perhaps need to be better protected. So the next time something like that happens, you may decide to behave differently, and then maybe you'll receive a dream where a bear is really happy. You know, so it's a long-form process that we have to learn how to understand those images and what questions to ask.
Beautiful. Tukapa, we're going to take a short break. Wonderful. Thanks so much for bringing that into the here and now. And after the break, we're going to continue with all the beauty that we can discover about dreams.
The cutting edge of conscious radio, Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Connect at omtimes.com. Om Times, creating a more conscious lifestyle.
I'm Kathy Williams, host of Sexy Mom Abundant Life radio show on Thursdays at 5 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Pacific. On the show, we explore living abundantly in every area of your life. Ways to let go of limiting patterns and beliefs and to step into the flow of creativity and possibility, knowing you are supported by the universe.
With happy clients all over the world, Kara Johnstad knows that your voice is the missing link to more authenticity, abundance, creativity, and health. An internationally acclaimed voice expert, Kara's breakthrough methods have helped thousands of people successfully heal their voice wounds and extinguish the story of self-doubt and shyness forever. Join in group trainings, attend online sessions, schedule one-on-one time, and invite Kara to work with your organization and community. Get started today. Go to www.karajohnstad.com and receive a special guided meditation designed to fine-tune your inner voice and welcome you on the voice journey.
Why was the basketball court all wet? Because the players kept dribbling on it.
The dad joke. Corny, groan-worthy, but also one of the simplest ways to share a moment with your kids.
What did the buffalo say when he dropped his son off for school?
Bye, son.
So take a moment to make your kid laugh, because dad jokes rule. Make your kid laugh today. Go to fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Voice Rising. I am your host, Kara Johnstad, and with me in studio today is Tokopa Turner, an author, a teacher, and founder of The Dream School. And we are talking about dreams, the power of dreams, and how that also is interrelated with voice. Tokopa, you write in your book, "There's an ancient heartbreak living in the center of each of us between two unrequited lovers, Eros and Logos." And now the next part, of course, I fell in love with. You write, "Eros will possess you. She is a singer, a dreamer. Whose elements are mystery, magic, and earth. Her voice isn't pretty, nor is it sweet, but rather scorched with honesty. When she sings, the ache of being alive rattles and resonates deep in your bones, and it is with her raw passion that she pushes blood into an idea. Her home is in the wild. She speaks the language of all untamed beings." What is your experience using your voice to weave together and marry Eros and Logos?
Yes, well, I think in our culture we have very much developed on a logos bias. Mm-hmm. So another way of putting this is many people know the image of yin and yang. And yang is that, you know, that bigger, better, faster, go, go, go productivity that emblemizes our culture. Whereas yin is something that goes against the grain. It is more about quality of something than the quantity. It's more about that. I think of those fado singers, you know, who when they sing, they have so much suffering and ache, but in that brokenness, creates so much beauty. So that's what I'm talking about in that way, the willingness to integrate and live and walk alongside our grief and our brokenness, and in so doing, bringing a mirror to others who listen or to read or who see us and accept and love their own brokenness and the brokenness in the world as a result of that.
Right. And you were talking clearly about how it's sometimes difficult just to say feminine and masculine. Sometimes it's better for us to think in Eros and Logos or yin and yang, because the feminine and masculine, it can be so weighted, or we have so many conditionings or projections on what it means maybe to be feminine or masculine. So we know that logos means it's coming more from a logical, straight side, And Eros, we have this idea of this wild, passionate heart, but also, like you said, these deeper emotions of grief. Yeah, I think it's beautiful to imagine a world. You also talk a lot about the feminine needing to be, or this is how I understood it, reawakened in a way that is in a direct conversation with that which joins us to all living beings. And the feminine path, or the yin path, is the mystical, that is really turning on our senses. How do you work with that energy, Eros, Logos, awakening more our connection to the earth, the vital impulses that are flowing through us at all times? What's your understanding of that helping us to connect more and belong more to each other?
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, voice is a beautiful and powerful way to do that. And in our community, in the dream community, we gather together. We have these retreats annually, and mm-hmm. sometimes more than that. And during those retreats, we are doing dream work in a circle, which is an amazing process, because we begin to experience how we really are an ecosystem. And in that circle, we can see shared imagery and shared questions that are coming up to be answered as a circle. We practice at ritual, which is a way of weaving a living bridge to the other world, to the unseen world. We are in conversation with the plants that are growing, and we on the land that we work on and that we live on. And we also, when we get together in retreat, we're eating the food that grows on that land. But we also do a lot of somatic things. So when we're working with our dreams, sometimes we work in our body's movement and allow our bodies to always be included in the conversation around dream work. And we also sing together. So we have these wonderful friends who are song keepers, and they bring those songs to us, and we sing in circle, and it's really quite wonderful. A lot like as the experience I described earlier of my childhood, of a group of people being in ecstatic song together. So all of these things and many more help to connect us to the ecosystem that we are a part of, and help us to be embodied.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Yeah, I think that's the magic of voice also, is that it's a personal journey on one hand. I mean, we can use our voice to connect with our own heart and to connect with our stories and memories. And at the same time, when we sing in community, you know, if we sing in unison, all of those hundreds of voices or 20 voices or 5 voices can also be one voice. It's a magic that we can be, you know, we can be 100 people and yet we sing all the same melody, and suddenly we can also be so unified as if we're one body. And mm-hmm. I think that's only possible with voice. It's not possible with painting or sculpting or, you know, even dance. If you have 20 dancers, you still remain somehow 20 dancers, but the voice merges, it melts, it goes into each other's bodies, right? So mm-hmm. What is your take on daydreaming? We talk a lot about the dream, but are we walking in a dream, or is it there are some people that say
question.
The dream world is a some people say the dreams are our real selves and the day is our dream, and other people say otherwise. Do you find yourself caught in daydreams at times?
Well, you know, in the old days, they used to think that dreams only occurred in the deepest part of our REM cycle. But it was proven wrong, that because everyone's had the experience of just taking a nap and having had a dream, even in 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. So I would actually even take that a step further and say that there is a dreaming channel into which we can tune at all times. And I do believe that there is a constant dialogue between this world and that world. And depending upon our practices and our attunement to that dialogue, I think there can be quite a blurry distinction between what is waking and what is dreaming. So for instance, when we are doing ritual and we, let's say, pray for certain things, or we do a ritual around something, often magic will appear in waking life as if it were a dream. And so this is what we would sometimes call synchronicity. And synchronicity is like the intervening of dream onto ordinary reality. And this is something one can actually practice at and encourage and grow.
Yeah. That's when one sees suddenly the bird appear right at the windowsill, or when the butterfly lands on your nose, or... Right, these mm-hmm. Signs that we have from different realms. You do talk also about that the indigenous voice does not feel self-conscious because it's devotional, which I thought was very beautiful, because so many of us are suffering from not feeling okay with our voice, and yet you clearly create a space of longing within belonging. To create that safe place so that we can go into that sweet surrender and go into that devotional place. Is that your experience? Yes. That a lot of people, when they come together, that their fears just dissolve because mm-hmm. they just feel held and in that magical space through ritual?
Yes. Just to clarify, just because of where you came in on the sentence, when I mm-hmm. use the word indigenous, I'm not referring to First Nations, but in the sense, the indigeneity of our origins, of each of our right. origins, so that there right. is a voice which is native to the self, which comes out of the ancestral momentum of our lives, and that we can strengthen our attunement to that originality over time. And sometimes right. it just bursts forth in a moment of confidence or clarity. We may just have our voice sometimes. But most of the time we have to struggle against fears and invalidations and things that make us smaller and not connected. But this is something that can be practiced at, and the environment that's most conducive to bringing that voice out is a place of belonging. And so this place is, in the way that I approach it in the book, is not something that is outside of ourselves, and it is not a noun. It's not a static, like once you find belonging, you will always be there. But it's a practice. It's a set of complex competencies, of skills, and we can practice at those skills. And the more we practice at those skills, the clearer that original voice is, and it can come through unfettered and unhindered more regularly.
Beautifully said. You also talk about, you know, this practice of showing up and living more and more authenticity. You coined a word, or I'm assuming it's from you, the concept we know vulnerability gives great strength. You coined the word vulnerabravery. Vulnerabravery, which is a beautiful word. And for all artists like myself, we know exactly what that means, to be brave and to open our hearts and to have shaky knees and to continue to open the hearts and to have the voice follow strong and or not, and vulnerable bravery. Tell us more about the resilience that grows in us when we continue to show up, but also in that refuge of ritual or of safe places. I mean, that for me, that's I guess that's important in the beginning, or from my own work. It's hard to tell people just, oh, open your heart and show up if that space is not there, because there's a reason they might have in the very beginning when they start this practice. So maybe you share just a little bit more about your experience with vulnerability.
Vulnerable bravery. Yes, I love making up words. There are a few of them in the book, for sure.
There are, yeah.
So I think what happens is, because our culture is so impervious and the appearance of strength and fortitude is really expected, it is considered weak to show up as vulnerable. And I think this is an absolute devastation of the proper way of thinking, which is that vulnerability is very precious. And so when I'm gathering a group of people, I always start with this idea that longing, what we long for in our lives, is holy. That longing, that ache for what we don't have, which is absent from us, which is out of our reach, is the holiest place there is, because something there is calling us into the life that we are meant to step into. And so I always start with longing, which is kind of it's a big ask for people to name or to share what they are longing for. But there is nothing more powerful than venerating that place in us, which feels so vulnerable and feels so weak. And if we can elevate that and recognize it as holy, then you begin to live unsplit off from who you are becoming. So, in other words, if what we're longing for more than anything is a sense of community and friendship, if we can say that out loud, if we can share that with others, if we have the bravery to be that vulnerable, then what happens in that moment is a constellation of magic, where when you name something, it comes a little closer to you. It becomes now, you know, Rumi has this beautiful line in a poem. He says, "Where a lowland is, that's where love water flows." So if we can name that lowland, then love has a chance to come in and answer that grief. Love has a chance to come in and give us what we need. But if we try to hide what we need and what we long for, we will never move into that life of becoming.
And also has a lot to do with our ability to receive. I think that's a big one that a lot of people have problems with, that we are taught that giving is the greatest virtue. But we learn with time that maybe we ourselves have stopped ourselves from receiving because we haven't named that longing. And once named also, that we were not able to receive it because the love was there, right?
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
Beautifully said. I didn't know that Rumi quote. That's a beautiful picture. You also talk about, because we're coming, you know, to how we can connect also with our earth, and how this connection to earth helps us also to heal and to feel whole. And you talk about beauty has to be seen in order to complete its natural cycle. And so for us, not only to show up and be vulnerable, but you also have a few beautiful lines, and everybody can hear her poetry, Tokapa, you're the poet in you. It says, "Make of your life an offering to the debt that can never be repaid. Know the joy of this indebtedness for so long as you are beholden to it. Beauty will run through your life like a river gathering momentum." And then you continue. So what are the some of the daily things that we can just do to embrace this idea that we're given this precious life, we're given the dreams, we are story, and we can make offerings back to the earth, back to the community, back to ourselves? Is that kind of the idea behind it?
Yes, I mean, there is such a depth to that conversation that we can only just touch on here. But learning how to be an ecosystem, I think, is the great precipice that we stand on, that to learn that we are not separate. And this work of belonging absolutely has to do not just with each other as humans, but with all of the otherness that is all around us, that we are not in conversation with the natural world for the most part. And so learning how to be an ecosystem is a great endeavor. But I think one of the simplest things that you can do, and one of the things that was life transforming for me, was to keep a daily list of beautiful things. I just call them beautiful things. And I just name them. I write them down. And the reason why this is so transformative is because as you get into the practice, if you know that you have to write things down at the end of the day, then you look for them everywhere you go, and your whole countenance towards the world changes, and you begin to put them in your virtual pocket, so to speak. So this is an amazing practice that you can get you started of just noticing the ways in which you are gifted, in which you are blessed. It could be as simple as a luxurious piece of chocolate that you eat, or it might be a moment of staggering beauty, like watching the autumn leaves change on a particular tree. Whatever it is, to notice them and collect them. And that is a very good start.
It was a very good start. We know about gratitude journals, but beauty journals, I think these are beautiful. This is always what's nice, is to take inspiration and to breathe that in, but to also then anchor it into real practice. And I think these tips or suggestions or inspirations, it helps us, as you said, to really become aware of how blessed we are, how many things do surround us, a little daisy that's breaking through maybe even the cement sidewalk in New York City. You know, it's everywhere. There's beauty to be found.
As if it's not doing enough, or if it's not taking action enough in a way that we're in quite a time of crisis. But actually, what we need primarily is connection. And from connection and the appreciation of beauty comes a natural responsibility and a natural generosity that wants to give back to that which is providing for us.
Exactly. We are in these challenging times. And I think you say that very beautifully, that it is through this this connection and this awareness that it's then natural that we give back to the earth, and that we create these ecosystems that are sustainable, in reclaiming our stories. And as you say in the book, kissing our own beautiful idiot lives. I mean, that's such a beautiful line. Kissing our own beautiful idiot lives. I loved it. We are contributing to the larger presence. We need to cross the threshold of our collective initiation. This is what your work is. And what's so phenomenal is that, you know, we think it's the dreams maybe that we have during the sleep, but these have such a profound effect on, help me with the beginning. You said our displacement, our ancestral line, so that, you know, we're coming, many of us from, you know, our ancestors are coming also from wars, from famine, from all over the world. Then we have the displacement as maybe children in the whole family or school systems. There was one more tokapā that I forgot.
One more kind of displacement? Well, yeah. There's slavery and genocide. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, many different kinds of trauma that have happened for people intergenerationally. And so what was the question?
Well, the question is that when, you know, now we're landing here at reclaiming our stories and really creating the ecosystem. You just said it so beautifully that it, when we start seeing beauty, when we start connecting with our dreams, when we start doing the inner work, I would say it like that, then actually it is shown in the outer system. And these, the collective conscious can raise itself up very organically and naturally. Because for a lot of people, they're going into fear in this moment of time. There's a lot of fear that, you know, the earth is not going to make it, that there's a lot of violence, there's a lot of illness. And what I understood from you was to say, but when we come to a place of beauty and reclaiming our stories and really doing that inner work, that the rest can connect also very quickly. The synchronicities can appear. The magic is there.
Well, I have always been interested in the roots of things. And so when I look at what's happening in the world right now, I really believe that the trauma of war and genocide and slavery and all of those things is at the root of our alienation, both as a human, you know, culture, but also at the level of being disconnected from nature, which has resulted in these crises that we're speaking of. So until we can actually heal or learn a different way of being, that wound of alienation will always exist. So I believe there is a tremendous symmetry between doing the work around belonging in our personal lives and how to navigate this collective initiation that we're going through at this time.
Beautiful. Tokapau, it's a great pleasure to have you on the show today. For all of the listeners out there, the book is Belonging, Remembering Ourselves Home. Yeah, it comes with not a 5-star, it comes with a 100-star review here from me. I really think it is a masterpiece.
Thank you so much, Kara.
Yeah, thank you so much. I hope to have you back again soon, and let us know when you have more book writing adventures.
I will. You can always visit me at tokopa.com.
Yeah, exactly. Toko, and I believe there's a minus in there. Toko.